Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn with John Munson joining me in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And before we get rolling on the economy, we are in our Half the Time pledge drive, and we're asking you to help make this program possible with your pledge of support.
That's right, Kathleen. We've cut this drive down from 12 days to just six.
Yes.
What were we thinking? We're crazy here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
I know.
We're crazy about our listeners. That's the truth. Well, this means more talk about the issues you care about, like the economy, and less on-air fundraising. But I'll tell you what, there's only one way this crazy idea has a chance of working. That's when you give right now at WPR.org or at 888-202-2552.
Last hour, we had a goal of 80 pledges, and we heard from how many listeners?
104.
Woo! Marvelous. Thank you very much for all of those pledges. Our goal now is to get 60 pledges by 10 o'clock.
Very doable.
Yeah.
Your support will fund the programs you rely on in the months to come, like the Kathleen Dunn program, and it helps us keep pledge drive short. Be part of our first ever Half the Time pledge drive. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
On WPR's Ideas Network, you hear substantial topics, as you well know. David K. Johnston has the mind. He knows tax policy and history since almost, you know, forever, last 100 years. He's really a sharp guy. And he gives us fairly often great information about what's going on with taxes, with companies going overseas. He has been looking at the protests on Wall Street recently and has been writing a lot about that. They're all important topics, as you know. We're becoming informed. Make your donation in support of these programs you count on at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It only takes a couple of minutes, Kathleen. We just need a name, contact information, the amount of the pledge, and, well, how the payment's going to be made. So consider using your credit card. That saves time, postage, and paper, and puts your money to work right away, no matter how you choose to give or how much. Take those 2 minutes right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, David K. Johnston, about the demonstrations on Wall Street and what's happening with the world economy. And discussions like this are possible because of your financial support. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're calling it the Half the Time Pledge Drive, and there's a reason for that. We've gone out on a limb, cutting our biggest pledge drive of the year by half, from 12 days to just six. Well, that's a risk we're willing to take because we think you'll make it a success. We're counting on it with your pledge of support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You have made the decision to become a member of Wisconsin Public Radio, but you're looking for the best way to fit it into your budget. A sustaining membership might be the answer. You decide on a monthly amount. It will be deducted from your bank account or credit card, and you set it up to be ongoing.
Well, sustaining, automatically renewing memberships are really powerful because they're cost-efficient and reliable for WPR. Plus, they're convenient and affordable for you. So just choose a monthly amount and become a sustaining member right now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. Two pledges in so far,
Thank
Kathleen.
Thank you. Great.
Still looking for another 58.
We can do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
58 in about 58 minutes.
There
right?
you go.
Oh, isn't that good?
Pledge a minute.
Yeah. All right. Let's do it. Help out now. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Talk to you later. Always a pleasure to see Mr. John Munson from the beautiful, beautiful community of Superior. I love it up there. David K. Johnston is our guest. I always listen to him carefully because he knows what he's talking about. He's just got a great sense of what's going on in the economy, and he explains it so that we can understand this. The last time we spoke with him, I think he was in Singapore. He has a dream job. He's traveling all over the world looking at the economies of various countries in the world. David is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's now a columnist for Reuters. His books include Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. His latest, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Abuse Plain English and Other Tricks to Rob You Blind, and that's going to be published in January. David, hello.
Hi there.
Where are you now, David?
I am watching the leaves fall in my backyard in Rochester, New York.
Oh, you're at home.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I know you've got your dream job all over the world, and the world needs your attention, sir.
Well, that's nice, and except for being away from home, it's nice.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Wall Street, which you have said, and this is a fairly powerful thing to say, has the potential to change America from what Aristotle would describe as an oligarchy back to a representative democracy.
Well, I think this Occupy Wall Street demonstration and the others around the country are quite significant. I've been covering demonstrations since 1968. And have been to more of them than I can remember. Some of them incredibly violent and have come home myself, you know, bloodied by radicals or cops or unionists and longshoremen and teamsters. And this movement is different because at Occupy Wall Street, what you will find are atheists and believers, high school dropouts and college advanced degree holders, people with a wide variety of viewpoints, liberals and libertarians, who are united on one point, and that is that the banks have ripped off the economy, have ruined their economic lives, and nobody is doing anything about it. That makes it different from, say, Take Back the Night, where you have, you know, a focused group that's anti-rape, or the Tea Partiers, who have a focused view of the world. These are people whose solutions are a lot different, but they are absolutely united on this fundamental point about what's gone wrong. And I think they're right. And Ben Bernanke has expressed sympathy, saying it's not unreasonable for them to have the view that it's the banking system that caused all of this damage.
The thing that flabbergasts me, David, is that nobody is doing much about this at this point. And I don't quite understand that. Why can nothing be done? Why can't we create jobs and get people back to work? It's what they want.
Well, there are two parts to this. Let me deal with the second part. We can absolutely do this, but we have a minority in the House, and it's a minority of the Republicans in the House, who are absolutely against any kind of government spending to make up for the loss of what economists call aggregate demand, that is, the total amount individuals can spend. And there's something called an accounting identity. It's one of those things, 1 plus 1 has to equal 2, 1 plus 2 equals 3, and 3 minus 2 is 1. And one of the accounting identities is that the economic output of the country is personal spending plus government spending, plus investment, minus the net of how much we either export or import. Well, if personal spending goes down, if nothing else goes up, then the country has to have less. You can make up for it with government spending. Now, we are, unfortunately, because of 30 years, with the exception of two under Bill Clinton, 30 years of actually 50, since 1961, we've had four balanced budgets. Eisenhower's last budget, LBJ's last budget, Clinton's last two budgets. We have been spending more than we took in. We have these huge deficits that were run up during the administrations of the three presidents who promised that they were fiscally conservative and prudent, Reagan and the two Bushes. And as a result, there's a reluctance to borrow more money to revive the economy. Had we, of course, been prudent during those years, there'd be no issue today. We'd have a very small federal debt, and there'd be no issue about borrowing money. And there are things we need to do. I mean, we just got a big new report, one of numerous ones that have been released, that said every reasonable person agrees the infrastructure is falling apart. We are disinvesting in America. That's damaging our competitive ability. It is raising the costs of moving goods and services. It is making our economy less efficient. And it's a great aid and comfort to our economic competitors. Now, on the other side of this, why isn't anything being done about the people who ripped off the economy? You know, 20 years ago, more than 1,000 savings and loan executives were convicted of felonies.
Yes.
Well, in the 20 years since then, Kathleen, the law has been changed, and it's been changed in ways through both court decisions and statutes by Congress, and the way that banking is done has been changed that makes it very difficult to prosecute people. That doesn't mean you can't do it, but it's been made much more difficult because we've put in place all of these little subtle rules that I write about, part of what I write about, that make it hard. And here's a way to think about that. Imagine you get put on a jury tomorrow, and there's some banker accused of fraud in this selling of bad mortgages, which the bankers knew were bad. And it takes the prosecutor a day and a half just to explain his case. Doesn't that by itself engender doubt?
Right. I see your point. The Herman Cain, let's spend a few minutes on him before we go to phone calls. And you are welcome to join our conversation with David. 800-486-8655 is our number. He has suddenly, and perhaps surprisingly, become the front runner, although he's the front runner of the week, of the Republican presidential nomination. And what he talks about is 999. So everybody's talking about 999. So would you do the same and explain why you think he's at the front of the pack?
Well, first of all, let's point out that, you know, at one time, two people who were never candidates, Donald Trump, who was running for a new contract for his reality show, and Sarah Palin, who was never going to give up her $12 million income, at least that's what she made in 2010, were front runners in the pack. So how much this means, I don't know. Mr. Cain, who's a mathematician by training, has put forth a plan in which he says he would have a 9% tax on all corporate profits, and you would not, as a business owner, be allowed to deduct the wages you pay to your workers, a 9% tax on your income from any source except capital. Capital income would be tax exempt, and then a 9% national retail sales tax. A number of people have done studies showing the numbers don't add up. My column that's posted at my page at Reuters.com has charts showing how a single earner making $50,000 would have a smaller after-tax income. A family of four at $50,000 would have a smaller after-tax income, but someone with $1 million capital gain as their only income who's single would have 7% more income. The family of four, by the way, would have 19% less income. And here's how that works. You think about yourself for a moment. You're a business owner. I'm paying you, Kathleen, as my employee, $100. Mr. Cain says, I can't deduct that anymore, and I have to pay a 9% tax on it. Well, I have to cut your wages to $91. So now you only have $91. Now, you did have other taxes you won't be paying, but you're left with $91. Now you have to pay 9% of the $91. All right?
Right.
Then, on the remainder, if you consume your entire income, as most Americans do, you will have to pay another 9%. And this is the effective equivalent of a 27% payroll tax, in which both you and Bill Gates, on his earned income, would pay the same amount. A CEO who gets paid $100 million will face the same tax that you will, not a higher burden, because he makes more. On the other hand, if you're already rich and you are collecting capital gains, the only tax you face is the 9% tax on consumption. And if you're making huge capital gains, you're not consuming all of your income, so your effective tax rate might be a tiny fraction of 1%.
So why does this idea seem to be capturing at least some people's fancy?
Because it sounds really nice. Hey, 999, that sounds great. That's a lot lower than any rate I'm paying right now, most people are saying to themselves. Man, you know, the devil is in the details of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a silly plan. I don't know what else to say. It is nothing serious about it. And let me deal with the last part of it. Mr. Cain has embraced the national retail sales tax, which is proposed and pushed by a radio talk show host from Atlanta, named Neil Bortz.
What's his name? Neil Bortz?
Bortz, B-O-O-R-T-Z. His book has sold over 1 million copies proposing the quote-unquote fair tax. Here's the problem with a national retail sales tax. Does everything that you buy get the national retail sales tax applied to it? Think of all the things you buy for cash. Think about the places you've walked into where you've seen the owner doesn't ring it up on the cash register late in the day, or yard sales, or all sorts of private transactions that take place that wouldn't be captured. The creation of this national retail sales tax is so ridden with loopholes, inherent loopholes, that one of two things would happen. Either we'd continue to operate as we are, and people would furtively slip into buildings not to buy drugs, but to buy anything at all they can to escape the tax, creating a huge black market like the Soviet Union had, not the kind of economy I want to live in, but maybe some people do. Or alternatively, the government would say, well, in order to enforce the tax, we are going to eliminate cash. All purchases must be made using electronic debit cards. And now there is a perfect record of where you were and when you were every time you made a purchase that can be obtained by, say, your spouse in a divorce proceeding, your business partner in a dispute, somebody suing you for any reason whatsoever, and the government. It would be the absolute end of any notion of freedom. And here's Mr. Kane, who says he's all for freedom, proposing a plan that inevitably must result either in huge black markets or the absolute elimination of freedom.
David K. Johnston is our guest, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, columnist now for Reuters. His books include Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A reminder that we are in a pledge drive. It's our half the normal 12-day. We're doing it in six. We need for it to be successful, and we're looking for 60 pledges this hour. David K. Johnston is worth every darn one of them. 888-202-2552 is the number for you to call. And let's start our calls with Frank in Middleton. Hi, Frank. Frank, go ahead. Well, Frank, you'll have to call us back because we need to move along. Laverne in Monroe. Hi, Laverne.
Hello, Kathleen. Great program.
Thanks.
Hello, Mr. Johnston. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I believe you wrote the book Perfectly Legal, too, didn't you? And I have a couple questions.
Are you there, David?
I'm here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I hit the mute button to cough. And
Okay. Did you write the book Perfectly Legal?
Yes, I did.
There we
Certainly
go.
Certainly did.
All right.
It's a great book. But here's my two questions. President Obama talked about taxing the hedge fund dealers. They're the guys that's pushing those counterfeit derivatives that are growing at an alarming rate every day for probably the last 30, 40 years. So wouldn't it be a good idea to tax the hedge fund dealers higher than 15%? Because we really do need the revenue. And why not regulate derivatives or in some cases even get rid of them because they're counterfeit money, aren't they?
Well, okay, there's a little bit of confusion, Frank, in your observation. Let me walk through this. The hedge fund people are speculators. The reason that you see billions of shares being traded on Wall Street is that they have computer-driven programs. And if you can capture a penny on a million shares, you know, you've made yourself a nice piece of change, $10,000 in a couple of minutes. That's what they're doing. Derivatives are partly what they're doing. But that's being done also by the big banks, by a whole variety of firms that are selling these things. And the notional value, that is, if you added up the value of all the derivatives that were in the world in 2007, it came to something like 10 times the net worth of the planet, which tells you that this was paper, not reality. Secondly, hedge fund managers pay a current tax rate of zero on their share of the gains. What happens is their partners, they get 2% as a fee on which they pay taxes after their costs, and then they get 20 to 44% of the increases in the value of the funds. On those shares that they are given as compensation, their current tax is zero, and then when they close the fund or if they sell the shares, they pay 15%. Well, there are hedge fund managers out there in their 30s with multi-billion dollar accounts. And if they keep the fund open for 50 years, they won't pay the tax until 2061, and then they'll pay 15%.
Thank you.
Yes, we should do something about that. Absolutely.
I want to talk more about what you describe as the mantra that spending, not revenue, is the problem, which is repeated all the time, endlessly. Last week you said, you write, the idea that cutting tax rates, especially at the top, will pave a path to renewed prosperity is promoted by just about everyone in national politics except President Barack Obama and the few Capitol Hill Democrats who do not fear liberal as a political epithet. The other thing that's at play here is that when you look at the jobs bill, you have an overwhelming number of Americans who are in favor of it, and you have an overwhelming number of Americans who say that the wealthy indeed should pay more in taxes, and that revenue is part of the solution to where we are right now. So what gives? If that's what we're saying, why doesn't the political establishment who's not in favor of this respond to the people? Aren't they going to get kicked out of office if they don't?
Well, yes. And I mean, I think the only answer to solving this problem is that enough people who hold to this view that the rich are overtaxed have to be removed from office, or things will just get worse and worse. That's the reason that the Constitution provides elections every 2 years in the House of Representatives. The fact is that the federal individual income tax, which you will hear endlessly on Fox News and various right-wing radio shows, that will tell you President Bush's tax cuts brought in record amounts of revenue. Well, the federal income tax brought in less money before adjusting for inflation in all but 2 years since 2001, the year his tax cuts took effect, and every year since 2000. When you adjust for inflation and for the growing size of the country, the federal income tax in 2011, the year that the fiscal year that just ended, September 30th, it brought in 31.5% less money.
Ooh.
Than in 2001. It brought in, I think it's 34-35% less than in 2000. How in the world can we do what we're trying to do, run this huge military that's almost half the spending in the world, educate people, provide for the Commonwealth goods and services that enable private wealth building, and maintain the liberties of the people if the federal income tax has collapsed so much? And the people who argue about this generally, A, don't understand the numbers, they haven't looked at the facts, but even if you accept their argument, they think the government is too big. Well, what have they done to cut the government? I mean, it was President Bush who gave us the Medicare Part D, which is charging 7 or 8 times what needs to be charged for drugs. It was a huge subsidy program for the drug companies, as well as a benefit to older Americans. We've run 2 undeclared wars, and some would argue 3 or 4 undeclared wars if they count Pakistan and Libya, without any tax increases, which is unprecedented in history of the United States.
Let's go to one call. We'll get the answer after we pause for a moment because we're in a pledge drive as well. But, Andy, let's get your comment or question.
I think my comment, Kathleen, on the Occupy Wall Street, and I'm basically an independent, is that obviously it's legitimate for them to do what they're doing. I think it'll be interesting to see if they can effectively generate candidates like the Tea Party has.
Mm.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're not going to, your guest there, they're not going to sweep away America. They're going to essentially wind up generating, if they're fortunate, they're going to wind up generating candidates potentially even by the 2012 election. And so they'll represent potentially a counterbalance to the Tea Party, which in fact is good. I mean, that's what it's all about. I don't think it's good us to criticize these people, because then you get to the heart of, and I'm a conservative, you get to the heart of, free speech. Having said that, to the extent that they'll be successful is to the extent that they'll be able to generate within the system, basically, a candidate.
All right, we'll mull that over and get a response from David K. Johnston in just a moment. David K. Johnston is our guest this hour of the program. He's a very sharp guy who really understands the economy of the world, amazingly enough. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author, columnist for Reuters right now, and he'll think he'll give you the response in just a moment, Andy. Thanks so much for the call. I'm Kathleen Dunn. John Munson is joining me in our downtown Milwaukee studios. This, as you know, is listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio, and we are in our half-the-time pledge drive.
Well, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, John.
And I've got a report to make about how we're doing in this half-the-time pledge drive. Our goal, of course, for the drive was to raise $1 million in 6 days instead of 12. Normally, our fall pledge drive is 12 days long, and it raises $1 million. So far, we've raised $462,976 from 4,672 pledgers. So we've got a ways to go. This is still an incredible feat to have raised this much money in this few days.
Yes.
But we need to get to $1 million by Monday evening at 7 o'clock, and we've got a ways to go. So we're counting on you to come through like you always do. We've cut this drive in half because we want to give you more programming and less pledging. That's what you said you wanted. We need you to do your part and make this drive possible. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
This is a big thing we're doing, cutting this down to half what we used to do, 6 days instead of 12. So we're looking for how many more pledges, John? I can't see.
Oh, don't make me do math. We need about 5,000 more pledges to make this thing work.
What about this hour, John?
Oh, this hour.
Yes,
well, this hour we need 48 more to stay on track.
Right.
So that's
Thank
where
you.
We are.
Yeah, we need 48 more pledges. Let's do it. Think of all the programs that you've heard on this station that have been helping us deal with the economy and understand a very complicated topic. Make your pledge, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, I want to put a question to the audience. How many times have you been listening to the Ideas Network and heard something that stopped you in your tracks? Something that was just so interesting. You just had to stop and your mouth maybe dropped open and you went, what? Well, you know, that's happened to me. It happens to me almost every day when I listen to the radio. We strive daily for programs that open your eyes and engage your brain, programs that affect your life, programs that make you think, and they might not always present views that you agree with necessarily, but they make you think, and that's the important thing. Well, this kind of radio only happens when you support it financially. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
You'll be enjoying WPR pledge-free after 1 o'clock this afternoon.
Yay.
Yeah, but to make pledge-free afternoons possible, John, we need to pull together all of you for these morning hours. Your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Help keeps this pledge drive efficient. And thank you. We need to thank you again. Thank you in advance.
Well, you know, why should you give at this moment? Well, because you're listening right now and you're thinking about it right now.
It's the right thing to do, and you'll feel good about it when you do it. There's the reason. WPR is such an important public service, as you know, and you'll be making a wise investment in quality news and talk, entertainment, and music.
We use your donation wisely, putting it into the programs that you hear every day. So support this station that you value right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You let us know frequently when you become a regular listener to Wisconsin Public Radio. You really take an important first step that began a wonderful journey.
Now, take the next step and become a financial supporter. The step from listener to supporter is easy.
You decide how important WPR is to you. You decide how much you want to give, and then you make a pledge. Take the step now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Need 47 pledges before 10 o'clock this morning to help us stay on track. Please help us right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It's our half-the-time pledge drive. It's a short fall drive, 6 days instead of 12, and your donation helps make it a success. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you, Mr. John Munson.
You're very welcome.
David K. Johnson is with us. Before we left our conversation for just a moment for our very, very important pledge announcement, we were talking to Andy about whether or not the Wall Street movement, Occupy Wall Street, which is now spread all over the country, in order to be effective, needs to generate some candidates. What do you say to that, David?
That's exactly what I ended my column by saying, that unless this results in viable candidates who run for office and change what's going on Capitol Hill than done to Master Hill of Beans. I don't think the people there at Occupy Wall Street necessarily have to be the ones who do that. I think that if, however, it gets people thinking about what the heck happened and how come now things aren't getting fixed and why are people on Capitol Hill coming up with these non-solutions? And remember, in 2010, the Republicans said it's all about jobs. Put us in office, it's all about jobs. There's been no jobs bill whatsoever. There have been bills in all sorts of folderol and issues about personal lifestyle. And the president's proposal isn't even going to come up for a vote in the House. They won't even bring it up for a vote.
Yeah. Let's go to Elizabeth from Milwaukee. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I'm wondering what goodies for the financial industry is in the new trade agreements they just passed.
Boy, that's a good question, Elizabeth. I don't know because I haven't read through them. What I can tell you we do know is this. The president and Mitch McConnell, two different, very different people view of the world, have both talked about the Korean trade agreement as creating some number of jobs in the U.S., some tens of thousands. What they haven't mentioned is that the same math shows that it will destroy other jobs, and the net result is a loss of about 70,000 jobs. These agreements, while called free trade agreements, are nothing of the sort. If you go to Korea, you'll have a very hard time finding an American car compared to finding a Kia or a Hyundai here. And the proposed agreements that we have essentially are really agreements designed by the financier class to engage in a labor arbitrage. That is to take advantage of low-cost labor in other places to replace high-cost labor here. And the people who benefit from that are the people who now have better jobs or will have better jobs in the other countries and the financiers who finance these deals.
Tell us, because I know you're doing traveling around the world, not that the subject isn't big enough here in the United States, but let's take a world view of this for a moment. We recently did a show on Ireland and Iceland and Greece. And you read the papers, and there is news that the Eurozone is about to collapse, and if that happens, things will be even worse than they are. Do you think that could happen, and how do we figure in the world when we look at the financial picture of the U.S.?
Well, Europe is a problem of its own making when they created the Eurozone and the Euro. The result is that the Germans, for example, are able to do better than they would if they still had the Deutsche Mark on sales because the cost of German goods is relatively suppressed as a result of the euro. On the other hand, places like Greece, which if they still had the drachma, could get out of their situation by adjusting foreign exchange rates, can't do that any more than Alabama can use that mechanism in the United States. The reason the Germans and to a lesser extent the French are so willing to prop up Greece in particular is because it's cheaper than the alternative. They're not doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing this as cold-blooded practical decisions. Whether the euro survives, I think, is an interesting question, and if it does, it will certainly lead to a lot more turmoil before it's done. Fundamentally around the world, but here's the problem we face. Everywhere around the world, we have borrowed so much because modern financial instruments have made it so easy to borrow money and even easier for the people on the lending side to take profits they haven't earned yet by reducing the thing called net present value and then shaving off their fee, even if the net present value never actually materializes, that we have pledged the future and we have constrained our ability to consume. And therefore, people spending on a worldwide basis equals income. And if people are spending too much of their money on debt service, then money is going to interest payments to people who already have more than they can consume. And it is we need to get off that.
Thanks, Elizabeth, for your call. We go to John in Milwaukee. Hi, John.
Hi, my question goes back to Occupy Wall Street. One of the big costs of the U.S. taxpayer has been the financial industry, and I'm wondering why Occupy Wall Street hasn't asked for a financial tax. 30 years ago, I could buy $1,000 worth of stock, and it would cost me $70 to $100. Today, I can buy it for $9. And if you look at the volume of the number of shares traded on New York Stock Exchange. It's gone from 100 million a day to 6 billion a day.
Oh, my.
It seems like if we put an insignificant tax of like 1% on that, the stocks and the derivatives being traded, that we could generate tremendous amounts of money and also reduce the volatility in the stock market. It seems like Occupy Wall Street should be asking for this, and I don't hear anything.
Well, the caller has raised a very good point. He's referring to something called the Tobin tax, which wouldn't be 1%. It would be a tiny fraction of 1%, but it would be a transactions tax. Before we had the Internet and electronic trading, we could have implemented such a tax if we'd had the political will. I think if we try to do it now, you will simply see all stock trading move outside of the U.S. to some place like a little island that the securities people will buy. The better way to go at it is to have a substantial tax on short-term profits. Right now, the maximum tax you can pay on short-term profits is 35%. If we put in a 70% or 90% short-term profit tax, you would, you know, gains that you make in a minute or a day. And in fact, if we adjusted it so the longer you hold, the less you pay, you'd see a lot of this disappear. And the 6 billion shares a day that are being traded with heavily borrowed money. 99% in some cases borrowed money and 1% the investors own money. And that borrowed money is a risk to you and me, even though we're not participating in this. And it is creating all sorts of financial problems. There is a chart in my column called Occupy Wall Street at Reuters that shows how much various public welfare programs, how many years they would have to be in place to equal the amount of money we committed to Wall Street. And at the peak, the commitment, if everything went badly, was $14.7 trillion. That is the entire economic output of the entire United States for the year 2010, and it is roughly equal to the total federal debt. And it would take something like 2,200 years for the Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program to equal that. It would take almost 100 years for unemployment benefits, even in this terrible economy, to equal that kind of money. I mean, we've never made a commitment to anybody the way we have to Wall Street bankers.
John, thank you very much for the call. Fred in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I just had a comment about, you know, tax rates in general and the way that we look at them in terms of, you know, when to raise taxes, when the economy is bad versus when it's good. And I just feel that, you know, right now that our economy is in such bad shape, I think we need to be focused on keeping as much money in the private economy, you know, taking money out in any form of a tax or, you know, fee or whatever that puts money in the pockets of the government during bad times is really only strengthening government and keeping our private sector at a disadvantage. And we can argue about, you know, who's got the money, the rich or the poor, you know, in terms of keeping their tax money. But the fact is when that money's in the private economy, it's helping the private economy as a whole. And when our economy's doing well, I think it's fine to talk about tax rate increases because, frankly, you know, when the economy's doing good, it's very hard to disrupt that, as we saw in the 90s. Whereas back in the 80s and back in the early 60s, we could see how keeping more money in the economy helped that private economy get itself back in shape. And that's really all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Fred.
You know, Fred is presenting a very common misconception. It is one you would not have heard in the years before Reaganism. Money the government collects in taxes is not taken out of the economy. It is not, as a student at Yale once asked me, do they take it out in a garbage scow and dump it in the Atlantic, which is what a lot of people seem to think. It's a circulatory system, as Adam Smith taught. So the government, by spending money, whether it is borrowed or it is taxed, can create demand, and the government is the source of the foundation of all private wealth. So right now we're spending $75 billion a year unnecessarily because our roads are falling apart. The trucking associations and the other groups that ship goods will tell you this is damaging their profits and damaging the economy. We would be better off and richer if we understood that. Next, you know, we gave these tax cuts to people very heavily at the top. 1/8 of all the cuts went to 1 in 1,000 Americans at the very top who make over $2 million a year and whose average income is about $30 million a year. they aren't consuming their income. They are saving it. And in fact, corporations right now have over $2 trillion of cash because there's no place to invest it. When you think about this for a moment, if your arterial blood flow were to be twice that of your venal blood flow, you'd begin to have blood pooling somewhere in your body, and it would begin to rot, it would get infected, and you would die. And that's, in a way, what we're seeing happen here. The tax cuts that we had in 2001 and 2003 were entirely financed with borrowed money. That's the major reason we have these huge debts, is we borrowed money to finance tax cuts, a big portion of which went to people with unbelievably huge incomes. And that's what we need to undo. So I think raising taxes on the highest income Americans and raising them in a way that encourages companies and individuals to spend their money, which Congress has the power to do under Article 1, Section 8, would be a much smarter approach than what we're doing now.
We will welcome a few more phone calls. David K. Johnston is our guest this hour of the program, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. You find him at Reuters.com, where he is a columnist. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David K. Johnston is our guest, and let's go to a Facebook message that's come in, David. PolitiFact Wisconsin has rated as true Representative Sensenbrenner's claim that the U.S. corporate tax rate is the highest in the world. Do U.S. corporations pay more tax than foreign corporations?
Well, the posted rate is the highest, if the Japanese law has not changed, the second highest in the world. So what? Here's the reality of what happens. If you have a corporation with assets of $1 million to $250 million, which basically means companies you've never heard of unless you work for them or they're in your neighborhood or they make a specialized product you buy, your tax rate is 30. Your actual cash paid tax rate is 32%, almost the 35% posted rate. But if you're one of the 2,600 biggest companies in America who control 70% roughly of all the business assets, your actual tax rate is less than 20%, and if you're one of the really aggressive multinationals like GE, you pay very, very little tax. What we need to recognize is that we have a tax system that instead of being indifferent, that is, the government shouldn't care if you're in the chip business whether you're making microchips or potato chips, we have a system that favors multinational companies over domestic companies. It favors publicly traded companies that are multinational over family companies. It favors financial companies over manufacturing companies. And as a result, we're getting these huge distortions in our economy. And simply cutting the posted tax rate will not do anything to fix this problem, but it is being sold all over Washington. As the solution. We need something that's much more subtle and significant than that, and we can do it, but we have to get a conversation going that deals with reality.
Well, I don't know how much more of a conversation you need to have until people start listening to you. We have a generation of young people who are not finding employment. They're losing their 20s. They're living at home in the basement. They're working at fast food restaurants. We have lots of people who are underemployed. And as you said, we have an infrastructure that needs fixing. We've just laid off 378,000 teachers in this country. It's obvious that, you know, to have a good place in which to live, we need to take care of the people who live here. People want to work. I just don't get it. The message, you know.
Listen, I thoroughly agree with you about that. And, you know, I have children from their 20s to their 40s, several of whom have experienced real problems in this economy. My students that I teach at the law school and the Graduate Business School at Syracuse are incredibly depressed about their job fortunes. And there is, unfortunately, until Occupy Wall Street, this feeling of, well, there's nothing you can do about
right.
it. I'm absolutely stunned at how unempowered people feel.
Mm-hmm.
Get out, organize, vote, get people elected who will look after your interests, not the interests of the oligarchs.
David, thank you very much for being with us, as always.
Thank you.
David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author. He's a columnist now for Reuters, and his assignment is all over the world. So you'll see his dateline, byline in many different places. He currently is in New York and has had an eye on the Wall Street protests. I'm Kathleen Dunn. John Munson is joining me in our studios in Milwaukee, and we are in our Half the Time pledge drive. You rely on WPR to bring clarity. That's an important word, to bring clarity to the day's news and to engage your mind with lively discussion. And we rely on the money that you give to keep that news and discussion going strong.
Well, that's right, Kathleen. We're here to raise the money for the programs you rely on. That's a pretty simple message. But even more importantly, we're doing it in just 6 days instead of the usual 12. So that makes it all the more important that you make your pledge of any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And I know we were looking for 60 pledges. We are now at
34. You have 26 left to get.
Okay.
We're on the way.
Hey,
we're doing it.
Hey, let's go.
We got to be able to
get 26 pledges for a conversation about the economy. What's more important other than our health and our families? But those are suffering because of the economy. These are really crucial conversations. And pledges like yours keep us on track to support these kinds of programs. They're programs that you count on, and they help us reduce on-air fundraising by making this Half the Time drive a success. Thank you so much if you've already given. If not, give now. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Well, what a great hour this has been.
He's an interesting
outstanding
man.
Guest. And, you know, now's your chance. Take a few minutes to make this hour and many other hours to come possible. Put a value on the programs you enjoy every day. And then make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Giving could not be easier, either at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We just need your name, contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you would like to pay it.
There's more.
Please tell us, John.
Here's a way for you to save time and money. Use a credit card if you can, or better yet, sign up for automatic sustaining donations from your bank account. You choose how to give, and then you do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You hear on the Ideas Network a variety of viewpoints from different guests. We assume you're all smart. The more information that you get, the better off you are. And listeners also bring a unique and extremely important perspective to the conversation. How many times have you heard, John? We hear it all the time from our guests after we finish the show. Your audience is just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
The questions were superb. Oh, what a great question, they say again and again and again. When you hear yourself saying yesterday on WPR, I heard, you know, it's time to make a pledge. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And you're in charge because you get to decide the amount of your pledge. You just go to WPR.org or call us at 888-202-2552 to support non-commercial radio. If you can, consider a gift of $1,000 or more.
Your gift of $1,000 will help pay for those who can't afford to support WPR right now. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 right now with your pledge of any amount.
Oh, okay. Well, we're looking, Kathleen, for 24 pledges in the next 5 minutes or so.
Okay, and, we can do that,
we
John.
We can do that. Where our goal this hour is still 60 pledges. We need 24 more. Thank you so much if you've already given it. If not, help us to stay on track by making our Half the Time pledge drive a success. Make that contribution right now. WPR.org. 888-202-2552.
Most of us, of course, regardless of what we do, like to have our work noticed and appreciated. And I thoroughly appreciate the people who work on this program. Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease are wonderful. They're great office mates and friends as well. So it's true for this program, for their work, and for WPR. Please show your appreciation by pledging your support. And I appreciate John Munson always for his good humor, his smart reports, and he does great interviews as well. So thanks, everybody. Show your appreciation by pledging your support to Wisconsin Public Radio right now.
888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Your pledge says, I want more. And because you do want more, you want more programming, less pledging, make that pledge right now at WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
After paying your bills, we know that it might not be very easy to find anything extra. That's why it's up to you to decide how much to give. Any donation will make you a member of WPR when you pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. How much you give is not as important as the fact that you do give.
Well, that's absolutely true. Giving to WPR is always a choice. And because it's something you value, you'll probably find that choosing to donate is enjoyable. Find out right now by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You may have heard the phrase, think globally, act locally. I'm sure you have. It's an expression that you can really put into practice by listening to and then giving to Wisconsin Public Radio. When you listen, you get the best news, talk, conversation. It encourages you to think big.
Well, and when you donate, you're acting locally to keep that high quality music, talk, news, all of it available to you and to your community. Please think globally and act locally right now by supporting WPR at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We ask that you make a contribution, and we also ask that you give an amount that is comfortable for you. Some give $60 a year, and some are able to give $1,000 or more.
Well, whatever the amount, we'll use it to support your programs, and in turn, you'll stay informed and entertained. So give now, whatever the amount that's comfortable for you, at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you, Mr. John Munson. Thanks for coming down from Superior to be with us in beautiful downtown Milwaukee.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Pledge, please, 888-202-2552. Next hour, we are going to have fun. We're going to have so much fun. We've all worn our Brewers gear. We're rooting for a victory tonight. We have a special, special something to tell you about. And so please stay with us, and we're going to talk Brewers. See, we do everything. We do baseball, we do the economy, we do dogs, Lincoln, you name it. Stay with us.